Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything, simply everything you can possibly think of, has its own history, like bananas, trucks, and the moon.
Ooh, the moon is actually all about cheese, the history of cheese. Or we could do braces, maces, and faces, laces, paces, and disgraces. So people being in disgrace, it could be a history of misbehaviour, misdemeanour, being in disgrace, being on the naughty step, being in the dunce's corner. However, that is to digress monstrously as always, because, as ever, we'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining extremely carefully and fully how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of rhyming is in fact all about singing games and the transmission of dance songs across the centuries to children's playgrounds. It's about Renaissance verse, Petrarchan sonnets, Thomas Wyatt, the court of Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, and World War II. It's also about nonsense and Edward Lear and the rise of professional writing. Isn't that good? That was one of our recent ones, and I loved it. Or that the history of hugs, and we should all be thinking about this at the moment, is all about the science and psychology of hugging. It's about babies and upbringing. It's about greetings and the gendering of hugs. It's about US presidents and the politics of hugging. It's also about free hugs, tree hugging, and the Kajali massacre in September 1730. Two humdingers of recent episodes, Sam.
Weren't they just? You're probably wondering who is giving you all of this information. Let me just say that he is the Lapsang Soochong of historians. If he could put history in a bag and steep it, he would. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam Willis. I too struggled with an introduction today. However, the man not sitting opposite me, because we are still social distancing. We're still at it. Well, let's just say that if he were a tea-related historian, he'd only be the Mr. Tetley of history. So popular, blockbuster, and palatable are the leaves of his historical steeped endeavour. It's the famous historical adventurer across town, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone. We're doing tea. You probably worked that out.
Yes, we are doing tea.
We are doing tea. What a wonderful thing to do.
Do you like tea, Sam?
I love tea. Tea fan? I'm a super tea fan. Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm a coffee fan.
Spent so much of my time in China. I've become to really, really like tea. I don't so much anymore, but I used to have, you know, a big variety of different teas I would select from depending on my whim for the particular day it was or how my mood.
Talking of China, I came across, as you do, a late 17th century transcript about the medical benefits of tea from China, transcribed by T. Povey, a member of parliament, in 1686. And get this, for all these medicinal benefits of tea, who knew? One, It purifies the blood of that which is gross and heavy. It vanquisheth heavy dreams. It easeth the brain of heavy damps, easeth and cureth giddiness and pains in the head, prevents the dropsy, dryeth moist humours in the head, consumes rawness, opens obstructions, clears the sight, cleanseth and purifieth adult's humour and a hot liver, purifieth defects of the bladder and kidneys, vanquisheth superfluous sleep, drives away dizziness, makes one nimble and valiant, encourageth the heart and drives away fear, drives away all pains of the colic, which proceed from wind, strengthens the inward parts and prevents consumption, strengthens memory, sharpens the will and quickens the understanding, purgeth safely the gall, strengthens the use of due benevolence. Who would have thought that tea could be so powerful?
I love the vanquisheth superfluous sleep. My teenage kids could do with some of that.
Yes, I bet they could.
That is fantastic, actually. And one of the things I wanted to do at the beginning is sit down and think of all the different ways we might approach the history of tea. And it struck me early on that you can... my original thoughts you can do an imperial history of tea. It's how East meets West. It's why the British got involved in all sorts of wars all over the world. So the imperial aspect was a pretty obvious one. And then I was thinking about medicinal nature, because I'd done quite a lot of stuff in China on Chinese medicine, a tea which features very highly in. And I was also thinking about... the rituals of tea. I was talking to the director of the Australian National Maritime Museum the other week about Captain Cook, and he was telling me a story about a tea tray made in the 18th century, a japanned tea tray, called japanned, it's a kind of type of enamelling, Japan tea tray, which was decorated with an image of the death of Captain Cook, and it's one of all sorts of memorial mementos made after Cook was killed on the beach in the Pacific. So I suddenly thought about the whole ritual to do with tea and how that has changed and how it varies from country to country. So if you drink tea in Japan, it's a completely different experience to drinking tea in China or drinking tea with my granny in Dorset, whatever it might be.
I remember once going to a wedding in London, a Chinese wedding in London, which had an extraordinarily elaborate and hierarchical tea drinking ceremony. And it basically involved the sort of senior members of the family and the bride and groom, and everyone else was just sort of left to fend for themselves, and got incredibly drunk because there was nothing else to do for like 3 hours while this ceremony went on. It was quite extraordinary. But I too am going to be talking a little bit about ceremony. I think for me, I wasn't that interested in the tea. I wasn't actually interested in the sort of the drink or the leaves or anything. I'm interested in the culture of tea drinking, tea cups, and all the sort of protocols that surround that, and in particular about 18th century politeness. So I'm going to have a big thing on that, and the material culture of the teapot and the teaspoon and the tea table and all of those sort of things, times for tea, all of that sort of thing. And then I want to think about the negative impact of tea as well, you know, and tea drinking possibly being bad for you and seen as sort of something that one shouldn't overindulge in. But then also, you know, problems with the tea trade and with people adulterating tea so that they cut it down so that they can make more profit out of it, the theft of tea, all of that sort of stuff. And also from a gendered point of view, you know, that a lot of these routines that built up around tea drinking and tea time and how you dress and how you should be, and, you know, are not only, they're not just shows of wealth and status, but also in a sort of quite insidious, silent way, it is a way of constraining women, you know, who are sort of particularly active in the rituals of tea.
Interesting.
Do you get them to make tea rather than, you know, do important things?
Yeah, okay. Let me start with a bit of ancient deep history. I'm going to talk about somewhere called Tianlo Shan, which is one of China's earliest societies. It's an archaeological site. and it's Neolithic. It's thousands BC, 5,000 BC, maybe 6,000, maybe 7,000 BC. And it's fascinating for what it tells us about the early roots of Chinese agriculture. The early roots of farming. They found a village. It's very large. There's all sorts of wooden architectural remains. But crucially, it's in an area of marshland. So they found all sorts of wonderful organic matter as well. They found wood, mats, rice husks, which is interesting. I'll talk about that in a minute. Acorns, fruits and berries. And a huge collection of stone tools, which then has allowed historians and archaeologists to look at the trade in the region, as well as what was going on there and what they were eating. The excavation, the quality of it, and the sheer size is extraordinary. I went there and I looked around and I got to go to the kind of behind the scenes where there was a warehouse the size of a kind of aircraft hangar, I could only describe it as, with boxes full of artifacts stacked to the ceiling. I've never seen anything like it in my entire life. And remember just how old this is. You know, it's 5,000 BC, maybe. Extraordinary. When I was there, they were looking in particular at they were trying to piece together the remains of an ancient meal of fish, which someone had been eating when whatever happened. No one really knows what happened, but there was a nice little deposit of the bones of a little fish meal. So they were looking at it. They know they ate a lot of fish there, lots of water in the area, it was marshland. But there was loads of other things as well that the archaeologists were able to discover, and one of which is that they actually found some tea leaves, which is really, really interesting. And they don't know exactly what was going on, whether they were stewing the leaves in hot water and drinking them like we do. But they're definitely tea leaves, they're definitely from tea, and they're definitely within a context of food. So there is some evidence here of people in China drinking tea in the Neolithic period, which I absolutely loved. The idea of what we're going to be talking about now coming forward, just being just that old. This is you know, the period where they're just beginning to domesticate wild rice, which is fascinating. And they work that out because they look at the ratio of rice to other plant remains that has been discovered in that area. It increases during this period from like 8% to almost a quarter, which proves that rice becomes a much, much bigger part of their diet. They're also using different types of rice, and they can prove that. So then they know that the rice which is being eaten is of a particular type which suits itself to agriculture. And that whole process of domesticating rice actually takes about 2,000 years. And this is very, very early on, right at the absolute beginnings of it. And the archaeologists actually found paddy fields around this Neolithic, or the early origins of paddy fields around this Neolithic village. So immensely old, but quite a good place for us to start, I think, James.
Yes, very good, Sam. Very, very good. Let me take you from those ancient Chinese teas to the 18th century. And I think one of the things that you see in the 18th century is tea becoming really popular among polite circles, and what you see is throughout all sorts of records, whether they're letters, diaries, poems, pictures, even material culture, there's an enormous amount of material that suggests tea drinking is coming into polite society, all sorts of paraphernalia, and the tea table in particular and all the sort of equipment upon it is a place where you know, women of sort of breeding could really you know, socialize with other people, could talk about topics, could show themselves to be, you know, of gentle status. And as tea drinking becomes more widespread and into the second half of the 18th century, as it becomes much more readily affordable, it becomes something that is associated with respectability, with domesticity. There's an idea, and this is a point that Angela McShane makes in a recent article, is that tea is being drunk rather than gin, so it helps with sort of alcoholism and sort of fear about it, those kinds of intoxicants. And also, if you have a look at what's happening not only in Britain but also in North America, you know, I think it's becoming a really important part of the daily regime for American society, particularly for women. And it's a way in which the North American Daughters of Liberty were able to show their sort of political colours. And what's interesting is that not only does it crop up in the written sources, but also it crops up in the material culture that survives. And if you go to the Victoria and Albert Museum, you can see some amazing objects associated with tea. And tea, the actual tea ceremony, the serving tea at a particular time in the day, all the sort of teapot and the teacups and the teaspoons, even the tablecloth that you put on the table, and all the sort of ornateness and decoration that's associated with that, that, you know, almost the sort of the doilies. This is all about showing status and wealth and a way of displaying who you are and where you are within society. And if you go on the website of the Victoria and Albert Museum, look up a teapot. Just type in teapots. And I've got one here in front of me, which is item 0777946. And it's a Thomas Fry teapot. So it's an enamel painted teapot dated from 1745 to 55. And it's got in it, it's got on it a scene of two couples outside a tent drinking tea. There's another example of a beautiful design of an elaborate teaspoon. So an elaborate gold teaspoon that's beautifully wrought, that if you had this on your table, you'd be showing off your wares. And this whole sort of tea ceremony is depicted really well in a painting by Richard Collins of circa 727 that's also in the Victoria and Albert Museum. And it's called A Family of Three at Tea. And at it, you've got a daughter. There's a little dog on a stool, and obviously a husband and wife in refined 18th century garb. And on the table is the most ornate, sort of what looks like a silver, sort of set of tea things. There's a sugar dish, a tea canister, sugar tongs, a hot water jug, a spoon boat with teaspoons, a slop bowl, a teapot with a lamp beneath it to keep the contents hot. So all the things that any self-respecting 18th century family would have on their table that would show their wealth. I'm also interested in this in relation to gloves, would you believe? Because there's so much material at the time about hands and gloves being used to keep particularly women's hands beautiful and white, and having clean gloves was really important, because actually what they were was the sort of backdrop to holding these refined teacups that you would have with you. So there's all sorts of politics there, social politics about cleanliness and protocols of politeness and hands. And of course, everything comes back these days to the history of gloves, Sam. So for me, tea is all about gloves.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee, Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
I'm not surprised, but absolutely fascinating as well. I'm just going to whiz back to China very briefly, and then I'll let you go again. I climbed an amazing mountain called Mount Tai. It's one of China's five great peaks, about 400 kilometers south of Beijing. It's got, I think, something like 7,000 steps up to the top. If you've seen Kung Fu Panda, where he climbs up, it's basically, I think it might be what Mount Tai, not the other way around. Mount Tai was not based on Kung Fu Panda. That's not correct. Kung Fu Panda was probably based on Mount Tai. And so what you've got is emperors journeying to the summit. And what they're trying to do is to control the world's natural order, right? They believe at the top of the mountain is where heaven and earth meet, and that's where there was a temple, and that's where pilgrims today pray for, right, like their own well-being and also everything for their lives and for their families. And what the emperors did, there was something called the Feng Shan sacrifices. Feng means sacrifices made to heaven. Shan were those made to the foot of the mountain, indicating earth. So it's a very clear distinction between heaven up the top and earth down the bottom, and how this mountain joined the two together. And we know that they were doing this as much as 2,500 years ago. They did it to strengthen their position in so the emperor's like the chosen medium between heaven and earth, and he's doing it to try and bring his rule in line, is probably one way of putting it, with what's going on in the skies, and to get blessings upon his reign and his realm. It sounds a bit nebulous, but it was very, very important to them. What's interesting about this is that you've got an emperor desiring order and prosperity, and they're doing it by offering these sacrifices, these prayers at the top of a mountain, because its location, its position is so important. And it wasn't just emperors who wanted or thought that they would achieve order and prosperity through this kind of belief system. And actually, it passed down through the Chinese in a system that we know today as Feng Shui, which exactly the same kind of thing. It basically seeks balance according to the principles primarily of yin, meaning the moon, and yang, meaning the sun, but also the sort of the organization of the five natural elements, being fire, wood, earth, metal, and water. It's all to do with structuring the flow of qi. So that is your feng shui stuff. And what's great about this is that I went to a feng shui forest, and they're really, really cool. And I didn't know they existed before I ever went to one. And what they are is particular types of man-made woodland. So they haven't just feng shui'd their house, they've done it to their landscape. And we know that one of the earliest records of feng shui woodland being planted goes back to about 180. So a seriously long time ago. And that there is some really interesting records about where they are, and many of them still survive. And I went to visit one, and I chatted to a lovely guy there who has his tea bushes, and finally we come round to tea. And he taught me to pick tea. So that was my tea picking experience in a feng shui forest in southern China. They believe that people who live there now believe their role is to protect the forest. It's probably 2,000 years old or so since it was originally planted and set aside to be a feng shui forest in the foot of this extraordinary mountain, with these wonderful waterfalls running through it. And they believe that that particular forest makes particularly delicious, sweet, tasty, and inevitably very expensive tea. But I just wanted to draw your attention to the fact that, the tea comes from some very special tea comes from feng shui woodland, which is ancient sort of manufactured woodland throughout the landscape of southern China.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. You should get some, James. Get some feng shui forest tea.
I will. I want to talk about social control now. and the negative impacts of tea. And I want to start with a little anecdote. It was many, many moons ago. I was a research fellow at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., which is a wonderful institution. However, one of the things that they have every day is they have something called Folger Tea. And at 3 o'clock, everyone troops down to the tea room and has a cup of tea or a cup of coffee and some biscuits and whatever. And it's an opportunity to chat and to mix and everything. And it's keeping alive a tradition that I think is really good. Now, obviously, the way in which they institute it is to encourage sociability and discussion of research, which is brilliant. But the library shuts very early. And so actually taking out half an hour at a particular point in the day, 3 o'clock, just after lunch, really, is a form of social control. Mm. And actually what you feel really guilty if you don't go to Folger Tea. And, you know, and those people who stayed in their seats and kept working were slightly sort of frowned upon. And I think this has parallels with 18th century society, because as soon as you build up all of these traditions that are about showing off your status and your, you know, and your finery and your teapots and going on these social rounds that we're so used to from all our Jane Austen and all the books about polite society in the 18th century, in fact, there is a stifling patriarchal tyranny underlying it, because what it does is basically it forces women into a domestic sphere where they have to play and dress up in a particular way in order to play these polite roles of, you know, mistress of the household, you know, or guest, or, you know, and or family member or whatever. And actually, you know, it's something that cuts away at female agency. So I just want to make that sort of very, very sort of quick point there. The other point I want to make, Sam, is that as demand increases for tea, there are various problems associated with it that actually, I think, allow you to look at the negative side of tea. One, as I mentioned earlier, is the way in which, rather like drugs today, you know, traders would cut it with various things. Heroin might be cut with talcum powder or horse tranquilizers or, you know, all manner of things. And so was the same in the 18th century. And genuine tea leaves were cut with things like twigs and, you know, rubbish from hedgerows and, you know, hawthorn and ash and all of those kinds of things. And this miscegenated tea was known as smooch, which they think comes from Afrikaans, Dutch word for a peddler or a cheat. And in his book, Tea, A History of the Drink That Changed the World, John Griffiths writes that so damaging to the honest tea merchant had the practice of smooching become that in 1776 a law was hastily passed threatening a fine of £5 or imprisonment for anyone caught trying to dye or fabricate any slow leaves, licorice leaves, or leaves of tea that had been used. So there's a real sort of, you know, a real sort of trade in dodgy tea going on. And if you look at advertisements for tea houses and coffee houses at the time, there is a real emphasis on the quality of tea and the price of tea. I have one here in front of me, which is an advert for a tea, coffee and chocolate at Tea Boots Warehouse number 212 in Piccadilly, the corner of Eagle Street. This is an 18th century one. And it reads, where the nobility, gentry and others may be supplied with some fine fresh teas, coffee and chocolate on the most reasonable terms for ready money only. He further begs leave to inform them, although the undermentioned prices may appear considerably cheaper than the usual charges of like commodities, yet he will warrant every article sold at his warehouse to be of the best sort and nowise damaged nor adulterated in order to reduce the prices. Green tea was 6 shillings and no pence. Speckled leaf tea was 7 shillings. Good Bloom was 8 shillings and 6 pence. Heysen tea was 9 shillings and 6 pence. Very fine tea was 12 shillings. So very, very, very extraordinary sort of menu there that we've got on this sort of this coffee shop in Piccadilly. There are also tales from the time about people smuggling tea and not only adulterating it, but also stealing tea. There's advice against smuggling. And people would steal tea caddies, and tea caddies would mostly be locked, you know, because the contents of them were very expensive. If you trawl through the Old Bailey records online, the Old Bailey online we've talked about in the past, it's a brilliant resource. They have digitised all the Old Bailey records. It's fully searchable. And if you put in a search term tea theft, over 3,000 thefts involving tea and teapots and caddies and spoons are come up, including the following, which was a thief who was executed. Edward Williams of London was indicted for breaking the house of John Cousins in the night time and stealing £60 of tea valued £60. The 13th of June last. The prosecutor deposed that his house was broken and his tea stolen. A door that went out of the cellar into the shop was broken, and the till where his money used to be was broken. But that not answering expectation, there being no money in it, the warehouse door was forced open and his tea stolen and carried out at the shop door, the door being left open, of which he was acquitted by the witch. And that the next morning, hearing of a parcel of tea that had been old upon inquiry, found it to be his, and suspecting the prisoner, he being apprehended, confessed the fact that he got into the cellar in the daytime, concealed himself till late at night, then broke out in the cellar into the shop and thence into the warehouse. The prisoner having little to say in his defence, the jury found him guilty of the indictment, which meant death. Now, to end, I want to sort of join up the dots and to talk about how the polite side of tea that we've talked about, with the sort of the polite rituals around the tea table, also intersect with these more negative, malign aspects of it. And this brings us to John Cleland's Fanny Hill, which is an 18th century novel. And there's a scene in that where Fanny, who becomes a prostitute, is introduced to a well-paying client by the brothel owner over a sort of polite cup of tea. So you've got the sort of merging there. And actually what's happening is the sort of polite act of drinking tea is used as a smokescreen to disguise the fact that actually, you know, we're dealing with a prostitute meeting a client here. I'll just read this little extract. Mother Brown had in the meantime agreed the terms with this licorice old goat, which I afterwards understood were to be 50 guineas peremptory for the liberty of attempting me, and 100 more at the complete gratification of his desires in the triumph over my virginity. And as for me, I was to be left entirely at the discretion of his liking and generosity. This unrighteous contract being thus settled, he was so eager to be put in possession that he insisted on being introduced to drink tea with me that afternoon when we were to be left alone. Nor would he hearken to the procuress's remonstrances that I was not sufficiently prepared and ripened for such an attack, that I was yet too green and untamed, having been scarce 24 hours in her house. So there we are, Sam. There's the sort of a journey around the 18th century history of tea.
Wonderful. Fascinating stuff, isn't it? All these different ways we can whip off and explore what's going on. Let me just, I'm going to briefly finish with where I began, talking about the kind of the imperial history of tea, or maybe the global history of tea. And this is relevant because what is happening in the Suez Canal as we speak, James? Do you know about this?
I was driving back and heard exactly what's happening there. Yes, I do. There's something stuck. There's something stuck there.
There is. They need one of those huge, big squeegee things you unblock drains with. there is a Taiwanese kind of massive super tanker called the Ever Given, and it's stuck halfway down the Suez Canal. Why does this matter? Well, it matters because it's blocking all of the hugely important maritime trade that goes through the Suez Canal every day. And there are now massive car parks either end of the Suez Canal waiting. Why does this matter? Why is it related to tea? Well, it's crucial, of course, because the Suez Canal was opened in 1869. And that is the same year that the Cutty Sark was launched. And you all know the Cutty Sark as being one of the great last tea clippers. So she's launched in 1869, built in Scotland, built super, super fast. It was during a period where they actually raced. There was a kind of a premium or like a bonus which was paid to the first ship that arrived with the first tea of the year from China. That race had actually been abandoned 3 years before the Suez Canal opened. But the point is, it's a time of building very rapid ships to get tea back to the UK as quickly as possible. The problem was the Suez Canal. Now, you can get sailing ships through the Suez Canal, but you'd need to have a tug. It was very expensive, and it's also very difficult sailing through the Red Sea to actually get to the Suez Canal. The winds are all wrong, which made it going by sail incredibly difficult. But if you could steam it, if you could go under power, it made the journey so, so much quicker. Makes it about 3 1/3 thousand nautical miles shorter than sailing around at the bottom of Africa, sailing around Good Hope. So it starts off with the Cutty Sark's launch. She does her first journey in 1879. She makes it in 109 days. But the problem is that she's up against steamers and they're going through the Suez Canal. So she actually very rapidly gives up, just within 6 years of her life, she gives up the China trade and goes on to the wool trade with Australia. So for those of you who've got your ear on what's happening in the Suez Canal, think about the very fascinating history of tea and how it's all related to the Cutty Sark. And of course, go and look at the Cutty Sark. It's wonderful. Made by, for the Jock Willis Shipping Company, James. White Hat Willis. I like to believe he was a relative of mine.
Family relative?
Well, I don't know. But he had a wonderful, wonderful family phrase, and it was a sort of a corruption of where there's a will is a way. And if you write that, it's where there's a Willis away, which is really cool. And he has that written emblazoned on the stern of the Cutty Sark.
I think you should have that on your tombstone.
Oh, that would be nice.
I'm not wishing you dead. I'm just saying it would be a nice epitaph.
Thank you very much. That's it. I hope you enjoyed tea. I love tea. We could, as always, as all good, great, unexpected subjects, you can go on for hours. If you'd like to find out more about what we're up to as we spend our lives thinking about the Suez Canal or whatever it might be, do please follow us on social media. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're inspired by my little maritime story, do please check out my maritime history podcast, The Mariner's Mirror Podcast.
And you can follow me on Twitter at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast on at Unexpected Pod. You can also follow us on Instagram, and you can friend us on Facebook, and you can see everything that we've been up to in recent years on our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com. Signed books galore.
Yay! Well, that's it for now, guys. Be with you soon. Bye-bye, bye-bye.
Take care.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Want truly hydrated skin? Meet Osea's Body Care Breakthrough, Hyaluronic Body Serum. It's clinically proven to increase hydration by 161%. It's lightweight, fast-absorbing, and delivers 24 hours of hydration for silky smooth skin without any sticky afterfeel. Treat your skin to clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order with code SUMMER at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code SUMMER.